So welcome to the Atom Podcast. I'm here with Alan Clark from Business Growth Partnership, and we're here talking in Scotland about the Scottish ecosystem, building a business, how you grow a business, raising funding, and all the variety of things that Alan has done over the years. So Alan, do you want to quickly tell people a little bit about yourself, your background?
Okay, hi. My background goes back to the University of Strathclyde, mid-1980s, where I stumbled across a class on advertising and decided that I really fancied working in advertising in the 1980s in the world of fast car, lots of expensive count lunches. So I did just that and then discovered it really wasn't like that at all. But by that point, I had got my feet firmly entrenched in that area and spent the next 20 odd years working in Scotland and Australia in the world of advertising agencies, dealing with everything from small regional businesses through to large multinationals like Unilever. I rose up, did a management buyout, became managing part of the agency, and rather unfortunately that coincided with being diagnosed with a very aggressive cancer. I had 6 months off work having treatment for that, and to be honest, by the time I came back, I decided that really I'm not sure I want 20 more years working in this industry. So I jumped out of that and landed rather unexpectedly in a startup, or helped co-found a startup in the area of hard rock and heavy metal music. An idea that was designed to basically take what was a very analog print-based world and move it into the digital age. I had 5 fabulous years doing that, but ultimately the point came where that business was heading in a direction that I no longer really bought into. And a little bit like my decision to get out of the world of advertising, I thought this part of my journey is over. So I left that and kind of by accident found myself into what I'm doing now, which is working with small and growing businesses to help them along their journey to growth and development.
All right, so there's so much in there. There's so many different aspects to your career that we can talk about. So let's start at the beginning. Let's start with advertising and marketing, right? So today, obviously, you're helping businesses grow through various different means. First question is, how have you seen the advertising marketing business market, sector change? And what are you, what kind of advice are you giving to businesses at the moment in order for them to help their business grow? I mean, you and I have talked before a little bit around some of the kind of modelling or the thought structures you need to put in place when you're advertising marketing. Just could expand a little bit on those, mm-hmm. and that would be great.
Absolutely. Well, like anybody that enters a new industry, I came in at a time and found a world that was a certain shape. 22 years later, I left a world that was an entirely different shape. And one might say it went through a massive transformation. Well, it did go through a massive transformation. But the reality was, the guys that had been in it the 20 years before I was there saw a massive transformation as well. And it has never stopped evolving and developing. And it's just a continuum of development. So while I saw a lot of change, I'm very aware that this was not a moment in time when something remarkable happened. It was just a part of an ongoing process of people learn more, become more sophisticated and understanding, and frankly, fashions come and go. So I came in when it was dead simple. We had the choices of television advertising, press advertising, poster advertising, cinema and radio. 5 real basic media choices. And on television we had ITV or the emerging Channel 4. So it was much less sophisticated, and that put the power in a different area.
Out of interest, how much information on demographics do you have back in those days on who was watching what and what time and that kind of stuff?
Compared to the availability and the granularity of information that's available now, incredibly unsubtle data. But back then it felt fairly sophisticated, because we didn't know that one day we would be able to break down the granularity so much further. I think the other thing that we recognised back there, and depends who you want to ascribe this to, Lord Leverhulme, or I think there's some American chap, but there's hundreds of chaps, that was still in the day of the fundamental, you know, half the money I spend in advertising is wasted. The problem is I just don't know which half. So I grew up, particularly in an agency culture, in the agency I worked for, The Bridge, which was all about a focus on effectiveness. We just had an ethos through our company that stood in great stead, which was about if we actually achieve the client's objectives, fundamentally that's the first, second and third most important things we do. And the more that we work on that, the more that we think hard and learn hard to make sure we're actually achieving objectives, the better it is for us and the better it is for them. That wasn't necessarily the way it had been. One might say, and I would say, that's maybe gone a little bit too far now. We are actually
over-measuring, in a way.
Over-measuring and an over-emphasis on efficiency. So if Lord Leverhulme said half my money is wasted, we're now in some parts of the industry are in a position where they are absolutely driving for, can I get to 98% efficiency in what I do? So I know that for every pound I spend, I am utterly maximising, interestingly, the short-term return.
Right.
Because measuring the long-term return is much, much harder.
So
of that Google ad that you place, but you can place a Google ad, follow the trajectories and say, well, I know that ad got me that amount of spend. And that picks up with this debate now between effectiveness, which I think is a be-all and end-all, and efficiency, which can be a difficult measure when you've actually got a longer-term perspective of what you're trying to do.
So when you're talking to companies now and they're looking to frame an advertising marketing strategy, where do you start?
Okay, the first thing I do is say, what are you trying to frame? An advertising strategy or a marketing strategy?
So what's the difference? I guess some people understand.
Wonderful, great question. I worked in an advertising agency because that's what we were called. That was the simple term for it. But really we were a marketing consultancy who created advertising as an end result. So it takes me back to, if you look at the definition of what is marketing, and I work with lots of people, and if I'm doing marketing work with them, start off by asking them, so what is marketing? And most people will tell me, it's about how I get my message out to my customers. And that's part of it. But if you look at the Chartered Institute of Marketing's definition of marketing, I hope I get this smoothly off the tip of my tongue, it is the management process responsible for identifying, anticipating, and satisfying customer requirements profitably. So a number of lumps in there. Identifying, anticipating, and satisfying. So satisfying is all about now. Anticipating is all about the future. And identifying is the insight required to be able to do the job now. Customer requirements. So it's not about what you're doing. It's not about what you're doing, it's about what your customers, it's about where their head is, and profitably. And then the first part of that question, a management process. For me, marketing is a philosophy about how one does business. It's a philosophy built around customer insight and understanding and developing products and services that become the best match to customers' needs. Advertising is a little part of one of the tools that we use, which is when we've got all of this marketing sorted out, how are we going to communicate with the customer? So within marketing, for those of us that know the marketing mix, depending your 4 P's or 7 P's or however many is involved now, there's also product, there's price, there's physical evidence, there's people, there's processes and tools. That all falls within the gamut of a marketing strategy. And also within it is the peer promotion, which is that bit about customer communications, about advertising. And I use a really simple little visual cue here, which is an iceberg. Your advertising is the bit that sticks above the water.
Right.
The rest of your marketing is the bit that's under the water. But unless that bit under the water is solid and secure, you're not going to be very much sticking above the water. You get that right, you're in with a real chance with your advertising.
So what mistakes are you saying when you're talking to companies at the moment when it comes to their advertising marketing strategy?
They haven't really thought through who their customers are, what their requirements are. They haven't anticipated what they'll be in the future. They haven't really thought about what their other options are. They're insular. They're focused on what we do and who will buy it. They haven't really thought about their product and service and how that meets the market demand. They do what they do and look for somebody to buy it.
So do you believe in product market fit? Because this is something that came up in an event that I was at the other day.
I can understand that. You know, product market fit is vocabulary that I've become familiar with over the last few years. It wasn't something we spoke about 20 years ago. In a simple, a more simple view for me, from what product market fit is, are we selling square pegs that fit in the square hole, or are we selling square pegs that fit in a market that only has round holes? And no matter what you do with your product, if it's square and the hole's round, it's never going to fit. So you don't have a product market fit. I do accept that you can't have one ubiquitous solution for everybody, and the world is not black and white, it's square and it's a square hole, ergo everything's going to be fine. But one has to match up, not what we do, dictating that there will be a customer demand for it, but start the other way around, saying, is there a problem, a need or a want out there that people are willing to pay to get solved, that we can solve? And if you do have that, there's a product market fit.
I guess a lot of people don't really focus on the problem piece, do they? They come up with the fact that there is a product, there must be a problem.
But this so often happens in technology. I have created this amazing new bit of technology. Awe-inspiring, my peers think it is the most amazing thing they've ever seen in my life. But the challenge in reality is nobody actually identifies a problem that it solves. So they're not interested. So you may have the most creative, most wonderful bit of technology, but if the market doesn't think it has a problem, a need or a want that it will address, there is no fit. Let me just also, very briefly, I see problems, needs and wants as three very separate things. Problems are where there's a driving demand that I need to solve this, I have to solve this. Needs are less pressing, less onerous. I need it, but I can get by without it. And wants are at a lower level altogether, a much, much, much less pressing need. Not really a much, not a pressing need, really a need. Wants are just things that would be nice to have. And if it's available, great. So if you've got a product, service or an idea that addresses a problem, and you have a uniquely attractive offer, nobody else can solve the problem you can solve, and the problem substantial enough, you're in a pretty good position. But if your problem, if the issue that you address is just a want, and there's lots of options already in the market, it's a small nuance in what's available, is it really ever going to cut through? Maybe that comes back to me a little bit for product market fit.
So, an interesting question for you. So, obviously you move from advertising into your own startup, your own business. Did you take that learning with you when you started that new business? Because it's quite an interesting business you went into.
Yeah. Well, let me start by saying I wasn't particularly into hard rock or heavy metal music. But what really got me was we started off with an understanding that there was this huge market where rock and heavy metal music, if you do any analysis, you realise it is a lifelong commitment. It is not like pop music where we go through stages, young people go through stages of they love one direction and then they'll graduate on to Taylor Swift and then they'll move on and then they'll mature.
I'm impressed with your pop knowledge.
And then by the time they're 50, they'll all be listening to Leonard Cohen. Rock and metal fans tend to get into it early, and it stays with them for life. And you go to, and it really amazed me when I started going to some of the big festivals, I literally would see grandson, father and granddad all standing together, because they shared this passion for this music that had been with them and will be with them for life. So that was one of those great marketing insights, where we recognised that there really wasn't a digital world. And what we set out to create was to take these people from a place where they weren't very happy. I buy the magazine for the news. Well, it's already a month out of date by the time it arrives in my letterbox. I struggle to access the depth and breadth of content I would like. There's nobody really super serving or serving my interest in rock music 24/7. A radio station, we created a national radio station, and that seemed like product market fit.
Yeah.
If we created it, it would address a problem that was already there, and arguably it did. We ended up with 5 million people using our services, touching our services every month. Unfortunately, not everybody paid for it, but you know, there was unquestionably some extent of build and they will come.
So, talk us through the journey. I mean, what made you actually switch from your comfortable job?
Well, if I'm completely honest today, that I sat with my business partner, there was two of us, and we had our regular strategy meeting, which was fancy a pint, let's go down to the pub tonight. And I hadn't planned on saying it, but the words came out of my mind, because I just had, I wish I could say I had a moment in the road to Damascus where the light hit me and I said, my future is never going to be like my past. But when I came back from my cancer journey, I knew I didn't want to spend another 20 years working in advertising, mainly because I no longer did any of the fun stuff, interacting with clients and making campaigns. I was now sitting in the MD's office, dealing with tenders and disaffected staff and issues around toilet systems that didn't work the way they should.
So you wanted to get back and get your hands dirty and do something?
Well, I didn't. Well, I wanted to get out of that role.
Right.
But when I had that conversation with my business partner and said I'm leaving, I had no idea I was going to end up doing Team Rock. That was one of those coincidences where a long-standing client who we didn't do very much work for, but the MD and I were of similar age and stage in our career, we'd always kept in touch for a coffee every few months. He called me, I went in to see him. He rattled into me to him, obviously. He didn't open the door, he just came straight through it in a slightly agitated state and announced, I've had enough of this corporate life. I'm going to do that ideal we've talked about on and off for all these years, because it came out, the genesis was in his business. He had launched a rock radio station. He said, I'm doing it. Have you fancy doing it with me? And he nearly fell over, and I mean, yeah.
Nice.
And only reason I said yeah, because actually I knew I was literally unemployed as of a fortnight. And the other element to it was, I had never started a business. I wanted to do something where I said, I was there when we had a blank sheet of paper, and I'm there when we have a live operational business.
So looking back on that journey, what have you learned from, so obviously being an MD is it's not a small job, right? And you rose through the ranks there. So in a way, it's a similar journey when you're starting your business and you're growing it and moving it forward. But there are obviously big differences when it's your own business, right? So what have you learned? What kind of lessons do you take away from that experience?
How long have you got? What I learned was that running a business is absolutely nothing like creating a business.
Right.
And I learned that I knew absolutely nothing about how to create a business. I also learned to take it one day at a time. I learned about having absolute focus on the end game and not worrying too much about challenges along the way, because we either overcame them or we didn't.
And I think that's important, actually, because most people who are starting up businesses, you'll suffer a lot of setbacks, right? But as long as you've got your eye on the prize of where you want to get to, then those setbacks, you just brush them off in a way and keep moving forward, because there's a bigger goal there.
Well, there's a lovely little incident that happened For those of you that have raised money, for those of you that have done an acquisition, we completed our raise and a £10 million acquisition on the same day in adjoining rooms, because we were only getting the money if we managed to buy the biggest player in the market at the time. I went into how that came about, but it was a bit of a journey to say the least. I had spent a Lord knows how many weeks and hours and angst trying to get most of these deals to the point where we could get them over the line. We got it done. The CEO and I, who was COO and our chairman, walked out the room and the release was unbelievable. My God, after 2 years of work, we've just signed the document. It's a thing. Billy and I headed back to Luton Airport to catch the 8 p.m. Friday night train plane back to Glasgow. Got there to be told it had been delayed till 4 in the morning. Billy was going off on one, by which point I frankly was bombproof. I said, I don't care. What are we going to do? We've got what we want. If I've got to sit my bum in Luton Airport for 8 hours, I'm not bothered. Anyway, the point of my story is, while we were sitting there, Billy turned to me and said, what would be the one thing that you would take from this journey now that we've actually got it over the line? And I said, don't ever have a plan B. Because there were so many times that had I had a lifeboat, I would have jumped in and gone. Because it was so difficult and so demanding just to keep going forward. But I actually never had another plan, because I knew I just had to commit to the big prize. And either I would get there, or I wouldn't. And if I wasn't going to get there, then I'd worry about alternatives.
Which is quite interesting, because you started a little later in your career, right? And a lot of people who start later need that safety net. They need that. They need the plan B, because they got children to feed and mortgages to pay and that kind of stuff. So it's quite brave, really, in many ways.
Don't hope my children never hear that. I literally, at the end of it, had to dip into my son's savings account for some working capital, i.e. to buy food for the house. And thankfully, that was within weeks of the deal going through. And instead of me having zero income for 2 years and having spent rather a lot of money, I now had a salary coming in.
Perfect.
It was never, you know, it was never about the money for me. It was about doing it, and if it worked, the rewards would come. And you know what? That business, I didn't make any money out of it, but it was the best experience of my life.
So, obviously, starting up in Scotland, let's talk a little bit about the Scottish ecosystem, because obviously I'm up here in Scotland, been here for the last week or so with Avrium. From what I'm seeing, it's a very close-knit community in Edinburgh. Glasgow's a little bit, I mean, there's a lot of great people, great ideas, but maybe not so close-knit. I mean, what's your view on the Scottish ecosystem startups?
The challenge here is I only know one ecosystem.
Right.
Which is Scotland. Glasgow and Edinburgh, 50 miles apart, I kind of look upon it as one system, maybe with two sort of slightly skewed areas, but really it's one system. I think you maybe are closer to the fintech ecosystem, which is Edinburgh. Mm. I think Glasgow is quite a good ecosystem as well.
A lot of variety of businesses in Glasgow, actually. You meet really very random people building satellites, building IoT systems. It's very encouraging, really.
So I'm not sure I'm terribly well qualified to talk about the ecosystem in Scotland in terms of a comparison to other areas, but what I see is there's a lot of emphasis put on Scotland building companies and building economic prosperity from within. And there's a lot of support and a lot of focus put on trying to help people grow businesses up here. I don't hear people in other areas talking to the same extent.
No, I think what I found quite interesting here is how joined up everything is. So you'll meet Interface, you meet Business Gateway, you'll meet, let's say, Scottish Enterprise or whatever, but everyone knows everyone and everyone's talking to everyone and everyone's quite happy to introduce people to other people.
Well, I think that goes back to the fact that this ecosystem has been developing for more than 25 years. And while names have changed and bodies have changed and strategies have changed. Like any ecosystem, the longer it's going, the more it starts to make relevant interconnections and identify where the nutrients are and go there for growth and identify where the weaker areas of the ecosystem are, and they frizzle away and don't receive the support that they didn't deserve to begin with. And it just evolves as it goes along. It is literally an ecosystem.
So if you are starting a business in Scotland, thinking, like, you're a person out there with an idea and you're thinking about starting up in Scotland, how would you start? What would be your advice to them?
I think that really depends what your business idea, what sector is it in. I think maybe one of the reasons Scotland is reasonably successful in this area is because it's very commercially focused. So not all ideas are equally of equal value. It really is focused on what is going to make a significant economic impact in the Scottish economy. So areas like financial technology, life sciences, advanced engineering, these have been identified as key strategic priorities for the Scottish economy. And quite rightly, Scottish Enterprise is aligned around developing those kinds of businesses, where your business may be a lot more manual or a lot less process, a lot more process and less technology driven. You know, are these really the businesses of the future? So it can be more challenging to get support for that kind of business. That just seems like common sense and logical sense.
No. Okay, so I'll ask the final question, and this is what I ask everyone. If you could go back 20 years in time and speak to the younger Alan, what advice would you give yourself?
Worry less and do more.
That's very interesting.
Grab an opportunity. Don't worry about what might go wrong.
So that is... So the worry less is actually quite an interesting comment. Were you worrying a lot about... This was when you were starting your business, and you were worrying a lot about the way it was going to go, the future heading, and all that those kind of uncertainties, or was it something else?
Well, it goes all the way back to, I guess, a fundamental about my personality, which was, while I kind of like to think I'm an optimist, there's probably quite a big pessimist,
right,
or at best realist, which says not everything works. And if it doesn't work, then this is a harsh reality. I guess the fact that I'm, you know, or another little point I refer to there is I worried an awful lot for many years about things that never happened. And having survived a stage 4 cancer and been told after the event, quite frankly, I didn't think you'd have hope in hell, I thought you'd be dead by now. I never worried for a moment about something that might have killed me, because I wasn't aware it was even a thing.
Yeah.
And I looked at a lot of very successful entrepreneurs who just have their eye on the big prize and say, if this doesn't go wrong, fine, I'll recover, I'll do something else. I maybe a little bit too much of that. So on the upside is this great big benefit, but what if?
Yep.
And now, actually, don't worry about the what if.
I guess my takeaway from that would be that really what you're saying is that what you're doing is not always the be-all and end-all, right? There's always other opportunities out there, and yes, you may think that what's going on at the moment is the most important thing ever, but actually, if it does go wrong, you've learned something, and you can move on and do something different, and you'll be,
yep,
better for it, right?
Absolutely, 100%. That is something I would say to any young person. Like, obviously, you can't, if you've got a young family and a large mortgage and all of that, there's an awful lot of pressure on you. But equally, most successful entrepreneurs have had failure in their business journey. So don't worry, one failure does not end the story.
No, there was that statistic years ago where I think the top 10 richest people have been bankrupt more than 3 times,
yeah,
in their lives, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, well, thanks for that, Alan. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure.
Cheers.
Cheers.